Good morning, everyone. This seems to be kind of the cat sitting group or something. I don't know. A lot of cats. So I'm very inspired by these days of practice that we have. Inspired because it's like such a true expression of what Zen is. It really speaks to the heart of it, not making separation between different activities of life, bringing our practice, which actually is not separate, but bringing it into our daily life, bringing our daily life with our cats and the doorbell and the shopping and making lunch and whatever, throwing in laundry, whatever it is we have to do, making that part of our practice, making it our practice, not actually part of it. And when the branch of Buddhism that we belong to, if, like, you know, as I always say, Zen for me, it's not even sure that it's actually Buddhist, but the branch that it is associated with, of Mahayana Buddhism, that the key, that's a very key moment when that happens in Buddhism, because that's the introduction of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva, meaning one who is keeping their eye on that ball, keeping their eye on the ultimate truth of emptiness, of oneness, for the sake of others. As soon as that archetype arises, we no longer need monasteries or monks or nuns, because it becomes every man, every woman. It becomes each of us in our life. The practice is, we don't need to leave home. We no longer need to go live in a monastery. The freedom, the liberation is found in one's own spiritual and material life as it is. So that's really a radical moment when the Bodhisattva enters into this tradition. And as you know, and as I recently talked about when we were in Sesshin, my way of expressing Zen is, or my way of understanding it and experiencing it, is its radical and subversive simplicity, which also is characteristic of the introduction of the Bodhisattva. Because the Bodhisattva will stop at nothing. Everything is valid. Everything is useful. Whatever it takes to awaken oneself and to help others awaken. So everything is worth it. Nothing is wasted. Which then, when in Zen, we really make a discipline of not wasting. We eat with that, in that spirit of not wasting. We conduct our lives, we live our lives in that spirit, meaning that everything, as Bernie Glassman said, look around you and you have the ingredients you need already. And those ingredients are, you know, all of the resources that you have, your intellect, your imagination, your mental facilities, the objects, the resources, everything you have, quote. So it can be your house, it can be your chair, it can be your skills that you apply in your workplace, whether it's planting beans or working on a advertising campaign or making pots or teaching students, whatever it is, that is all Zen work. That's all Zen life. And we just make the best use of all those resources we have, whether it's we think of them as possessions. So, you know, if we have a car, well, then we use that to give people rides, to deliver packages, to bring ourselves to retreats, to bring others to retreats, bring ourselves to our workplace, whatever it is. If we have a house, an apartment, we use it to house ourselves and our families, friends, relatives. We can have activities in the house. Some of us have sitting groups in our house. We're all using that our homes right now as a zendo. At this very moment, your apartment, your room, wherever you're sitting right now is a zendo, meaning a place of practice. You don't have to go anywhere else to do that, to practice. Of course, we do have dedicated places, we have dedicated moments. Today, we give ourselves this schedule because that gives us a discipline that helps us to stay focused, to keep in mind what is this all about. And this is all about waking up to the oneness of life, to seeing the wholeness, the non-separation. And with this discipline, that helps to keep us focused. So we do go to retreats. We do have places of practice, whether it's center, place where people live, somewhere that's rented, and one night a week we go sit there. Wherever it is, we do have dedicated places because they help support, it helps support the discipline that is necessary. But all of that just shows the way. It's all just showing the way where the truth of Zen can be experienced. And even me sitting here talking, my words, it's not, this in itself is not what the point is. But what I'm saying is an attempt to show the way. And it's not only words that, for me, my whole life is intended to show the way. The way that I live, the way that I move in the world, the activities I engage in, everything is intended to show the way. To be a bodhisattva, that's what the bodhisattva does. He or she shows the way by manifesting it, by being it, by not being separate from it. And you know what's astounding is that that's why Zen is not necessarily Buddhist, because this is a teaching that you find everywhere. Christ said it, you know, I am the way, I am the light, I am the way. Same thing, and I'm sure we could find examples in Islam, in Judaism, in all the great religions. Mystics of all kinds always say this, whether it's poets, anyone, any kind of mystic who is focusing on the oneness instead of the separation. This whole path is just saying, in simple terms, make the best use of what has been given you. So make the best use of your life, because that is what has been given you. And that's the bottom line. make the best use of it. So what is the best use of life? What is the best use of the ingredients you have in your refrigerator for lunch? I admit during the break, I was thinking about what I was going to use, how I was going to use the ingredients in my refrigerator for lunch, because I have to make lunch after we eat this. So how will I make the best use of that bulb of fennel? How will I make the best use of the tofu? How will I make the best use of the salad, whatever is in there in the refrigerator or in the cupboard? So there's quinoa, there's rice. How will I make the best use of all that? But that also extends to, how do I make the best use of this moment? So we've all chosen in this very moment to click on that Zoom link, turn on our computer, click on that Zoom link and be here. We've decided this is the best use of this moment. This afternoon at 3 o'clock, there will be some other best use, some other moment. How do we know it is the best use? Well, that it always depends on the context, the situation, the people, the resources, whatever is called for. And we have a better chance of knowing what is the best use if we keep our attention on what the point is. If we come back to the radical root, because that's what radical means, of this simplicity, which means one. I'd like to say, the Latin root of simple or simplicity is simplitas, which is not complex, means one. We even have, and that still exists in our languages to some extent. In French, we say, instead of saying a one-way ticket for an airplane or a train or something, we say an aller simple. One. In beds, for example, we say un lit simple, a simple bed. It's a bed for one person. It's one. Zen is simple. It's simple in the point, one, and it's also very simple in its in the forms that it has devised or are used to return to that root, that radical simplicity. It's much simpler than, we even simplify it to the extent of, you can sit anywhere. You don't need any special cushion, any special seat. You don't need any special room, any special ritual. It's that simple. And we could even say you don't even need to sit because you already are it. But of course, because you don't realize that, then we say, okay, then here's a way to realize it. Sit down. And then we make it a little more discipline to help us even more. Sit in this way. And then we might say, okay, and give yourself a little more discipline and sit at this time. Sit with these people. Sit in this place. But that's, all of that is not the point. All of that is just helping us to see the point, helping us to realize it, we hope. And so these days like this, I find so inspiring because we're just using the ingredients we have and in the context, because none of us at this very moment are in the same city. None of us are in the same, some of us are in the same country, but so there's 1, 2, 3 countries present here, I think. any number of cities, towns, neighborhoods. Actually, there are two of us in the same town. Claudia and I are both in Montreuil, but we're not in the same neighborhood. And we're using that. This is where we are. This is what we have. So instead of saying, oh, well, we can't be together. Yes, we can. Absolutely. And before Zoom, we devised a system to be together, which was on, that took place on my blog. And we all came together there. We just use whatever we have to look into this, the great matter, as we say in Zen, the great matter of life and death, the great matter of unborn just this, the great matter of things as they are. However you want to define the great matter, it always comes down to one. And when we experience that oneness, we call that wisdom. We call that awakening. And then what we do, how we act from that realization, we call love or compassion. The great mystic master Eckhart, I'm not sure which century that was. Does anyone know what century Master Eckhart was?
14th, I would say.
14th, yeah. Said, whatever is realized in contemplation, so whatever is realized in meditation, sitting, that realization of wisdom, of awakening, must be poured out in love. So this is a Christian mystic, but that's what we say in Zen too, right? The functioning of Mu, or the functioning of awakening, is compassion, love. Or we could say in Zen, we might say the whatever is realized in Zazen is poured out in work. We get up and work. We get up and act in the world. From this experience of oneness, then, we enter into this world of dualities, but we enter it from this place of oneness and put that into action, which translates as loving action. Bernie Glassman would say, loving action. An action that does no harm or seeks to do no harm, because it's coming from a place of oneness. Harm arises when we are acting in from a place of separation, of not seeing the oneness. And like I like to say as well, although I'm not a scientist, maybe our astrophysicist here can enlighten us a bit on this, but you know, from what I understand, nuclear power and nuclear energy comes from splitting the atom, from separation. Which is quite extraordinary, isn't it? This massive, massive energy and power comes from separation. And it's been used for destructive purposes. Not only, but it also is being used to generate lots of energy. However, do we know if that will end up being destructive? We don't know. But it's just an interesting aside that that very basic element of life, the atom, when it's separated, creates this huge, you know, huge destructive force. Not only destructive force, but it does create this destructive force. So if we keep our mind on non-separation, on oneness, if we try to see that, if we try to awaken to it, then we have a better chance of not harming ourselves and others, and a better chance of realizing our life to its full potential, realizing who we truly are, who others truly are, of realizing our creative activity. And when I say creative activity, I don't just mean artistic. Creative activity of skillful means, as we say. Let's say creative activity as skillful means, meaning not wasting, using whatever is here. There's great creativity in looking around and saying, okay, what shall I make for lunch with these ingredients? What shall I do with my life with these ingredients? Just to take it to like the big view. How can I not waste it? How can I make use of all of these ingredients I have in my life and not waste any of it, not waste a moment or a drop? Orioki is a great practice for that, because it helps us to see that, to realize that in real time. Not wasting a drop of water, not wasting any of the food. But the same thing applies in every moment. So today, when we have this structure that we've given ourselves, we have the opportunity to return to the basic ground, the radical basic ground of being, which is the simplicity of oneness. And by doing that, that's why I always add subversive, is because by doing that, this is very subversive, because it overthrows the status quo of delusion, of our own delusion, but also the status quo of this deluded world that we live in, that is not paying attention to oneness, that is not paying attention to waking up, that is not paying attention to loving action. And by choosing to devote ourselves to this day, we're like, this is a really super subversive act. And appreciate that. No, maybe you don't totally feel it, but look into it. Say, okay, what is subversive about this? Because again, like I say, it's the Latin root of subversive is subvertir, which is subverter, which is like to overthrow, to turn upside down. And that's really what this practice does. You know, it throws everything upside down, what, you know, how our daily lives are usually happening in this world and what everyone's telling us to do, what our governments are doing, what our neighbors are doing. I don't know. You know, in France, we have this, you know, it's a very terrible but perfect example of what has just happened around this whole retirement reform, they call it reform. It maintains the deluded status quo by not opening to the diversity, by not opening to, by hanging on to a fixed idea of self and other, right? And this is causing great separation. It's further separating what was already separated. Differences of opinions, difference of beliefs and ideas, and, you know, causing them to be even further divided, which can only give rise to further harm, chaos, violence. We see it play out in every aspect of life. If we're paying attention to oneness, when it becomes very clear when that is not the heart of the matter. So this is subversive. You know, you choose to spend your day focusing your attention on oneness by choosing to sit here with us on screen. Even if you just come for one period, you know, even if you can't be here later or you weren't here in the morning, it doesn't matter. For that, for this moment, right now, I mean, it matters because it's the difference, but at this moment, this is what you're focusing on. And that's precious. That's really, really precious. Subversive, simple, radical, and precious. So I find it really inspiring that we sit here and do this. You know, even if it was just me and one other person sitting here, I would find that really inspiring. And even the fact that we make it available and it's out there and people, you know, whether they come or not, they know it's out there. That I find inspiring too, that it's there. Because it doesn't matter the number. It doesn't. What matters is what's in your heart. So, if you can keep yourself attentive to the ultimate truth of oneness, of sometimes we say emptiness, if you can keep yourself focused on that, then your life will be transformed. Sesshin does that, you know, retreat. So we spend a week of intense practice, and that's what our attention is on. Whether we say it or not, whether we say, oh, I'm focusing on oneness, we don't actually say that. But that's what it is. That's what happens. And we choose to go there. You know, we choose to go away for a week and sit there together. And so we're choosing to focus on oneness for a week. And when that retreat is over, we feel different. Of course, then it, you know, it might fade. We forget. And yet if we maintain it, we keep sitting with other people, we keep focusing our attention, coming back to it, then we build on that. We deepen it. We see how it manifests in different ways, that it's not just restricted to that retreat conditions, or it's not just to this day, these conditions. That's why I said after the morning sitting, I said, okay, now go turn off your computer and go do whatever you do, but that's, you're still doing it. You're still practicing. I read the other day that, and I never knew this before, I think it was from D.T. Suzuki, who said kin hin, and he gave the Chinese words for it, I don't know what they are, means literally sutras walking. So sutras, like the sutras, the teachings, what we think of as the teachings, are walking. That's what kin hin means. That's beautiful. Goodbye, Miguel. He sent us a message saying he was leaving. Amazing. Sutras walking. And the same thing when we're doing whatever we're doing. Sutras cooking. Sutras feeding the cat. Sutras washing the windows. Sutras answering the door. It's all that. That's another way of saying, I didn't read the rest of what Suzuki said about it, I didn't have time, but it's another way of saying sutras walking. Well, that is like, so then I'm the sutra, I'm walking. So it's not only, it's not like some book of sutras that's walking, it's the sutras that are walking. And because I'm walking, I'm the sutra, I'm the teaching, I'm the way. Again, we come back to that. And this is just, you know, I've always been like this, like really enthusiastic and inspired, about this. And I tell the story sometimes of when I was my teacher's shisha, you know, and I was her assistant. So I would be like, because she walked into the zendo after everyone else was sitting down, and I walked in the zendo after her. I was the last person who walked in there. And every time I would walk in there, and I had this kind of flood of joy, and I would think, oh, they're here. They came. It was just such a joy to enter that room and have everyone sitting there. And the first time I went to a retreat, when I knew nothing about Zen really, I was amazed, and I've told this before, I was amazed when someone clapped these wooden clappers and everybody stopped what they were doing, put down their coffee, put down the knife they were cutting with the carrots, stopped whatever they were doing, and went and sat together. I had been sitting by myself, so I had no idea that this is what happened. Although I went because I did want to sit with other people, but I didn't know that's what was going to happen. And I still have that same joy and enthusiasm when I open my screen and you're there. And I think, oh, they're here. Oh, they came. And like I said, it could be one person, it could be 50 people, it could be 3 people, it doesn't matter. Oh, they're here. And so everything I try to do is manifest that then in my life and make that possible so that you can experience that, so that we all can share it, that joy. And it's not only, you know, it's the joy of sharing it with others, obviously, that's it. But that joy comes from my experience of how joyful it is for me. And so I want others to share that joy. And I'm so happy when they choose to share it. You know, it's always like that, right? We're so happy if, you know, we really like a movie and we talk to someone who really likes it too. It's like really joyful to share that shared joy. That's one of the paramitas, you know. My Dharma sister Corinne, that's her name. Mudita, shared joy. And that's what this path is about too. If it was just one person sitting on their own, then if that was the point, then we wouldn't be sitting here and this practice would not be alive and well today. It seems like a paradox because it's about it's experiencing the liberation in your own heart and mind. There's no other way. You have to experience it yourself. And yet it's collective, that we do it together. And life is interdependent, and so we're never alone, really. We are alone as this manifestation, and yet we know that that's not separate, that that's interdependent, interconnected with everyone else, everything else. So today it's just, this is a discipline we've created to experience this, share it together, keep ourselves focused on the oneness of life, the wholeness, and make the best use of it for ourselves, for the benefit of ourselves and others. So I'd like to open it up for comments or questions before I say too much. And as we say, lose my eyebrows. I say the Zen teacher who says too much loses their eyebrows. José Eduardo.
Well, someone has to talk, so sorry. you just mentioned, you start mentioning the monastic life as being something Yeah, a little bit different. I don't know if it is as different as what we do. Of course, is a fixed place. I suppose it's a fixed place. I have some fascination for monastic life. I don't know if it was previous lives or if it will be future life. I don't know. I have some this fascination for the monastic life, at least the one that I know a little bit, which is the Christian one. And it came into my mind because I saw it last Saturday. And if you have at home Netflix, there is a very beautiful documentary on the monastic life in France of Benedictine nuns. It is called Leur Souffle. So if you have the chance to see it in Netflix, I strongly suggest you to see it. Because it's so, yeah, you could say it's someone that has been living there for a while, I'm sure. And she really wants to capture everyone's life, every I think it's a community about, I don't know, maybe 30 nuns or something. So I'm not going to spoil it, but I do advise you to see it because, well, for me it was very inspiring anyway. And there you can see also the strength of that love. Also the title is already so beautiful, Leur Souffle. And so this is to say that in the end, perhaps, yeah, this monastic life can become stiffed or can become also too mechanical, I don't know how to say it. But that is also with our practice. I think that's, I remember one of the texts of Hogan, my teacher, my previous, or still teacher anyway. He has a very interesting text called The Zen Disease. And the Zen disease is actually this following the trap of just sitting, yeah, mechanically and do things mechanically. So, yeah, that was my comment, was to say that for some people, of course, the reasons why these nuns are in the monastery has to do with their faith, with their Christian faith. But when I saw that documentary, I found it so inspiring, and I saw it so many things that are common to our practice, in fact. Of course, the prayers are different. The prayers have this Christian tone. But the way they live their daily life, in fact, is meant to... Yeah, to lead them to the present moment, in a way, I would say. And of course, out of that, to pray, I don't know, for the salvation of humankind, or for their own salvation, I don't know. But yeah, what is beautiful is that then it shows a lot of other dimensions in that. And there is a lot of other images, a part of the prayers and things like that. So that would be my comment to say. In fact, I have this idea that these people, they wake up, they have a very, according to what I know, this, well, it's I guess it's the same also in other monasteries, wherever they are, in all the cultures, they have this strong discipline. But what I can see is that discipline allows a lot of freedom. That's what I understand. It can allow a lot of freedom. It can also become suffocating, of course. But according to what I know, it's the Benedictine rule. They start praying, I think I told you this before, at 4 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, and all day is regulated by praying. So it's they have to shift from praying to other kind of practices. And that's what I found. It was, in fact, I was watching that beautiful documentary, and I lot of associations coming to my mind, and I could understand it out of the session practice with. Okay, that was my comment to what you say. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, when we say that there is no need for monasteries, it mean what I meant was that, and what I think that most, you know, lay people in the West today believe, is that it's not the only option, that it's possible, because what needs to be left, we think we have to leave home in order to realize oneness or something, or pursue our path, to deeply realize our spiritual path. But what needs to be left is the attachment to self. So that's the home that needs to be left. It doesn't mean that it's not valid going into a monastery. It just means that that's not the only path, that it's possible for others to do it outside of that path, of the monastic path. Because absolutely, yeah, it's everything we've said. It's great discipline, great focus. Sometimes we kid ourselves by thinking, well, if I go live in a monastery, then I will wake up well, and I won't have any problems anymore. But actually, we just bring the same stuff with us to the monastery. Mm-hmm. So I'm not discounting, and I've seen that documentary actually, that I'm not discounting the value of it and the beauty of it as a path or a way. It's just that when I said it meant that it was no longer the only way.
Thank you.
Antoine?
One question about, you mentioned Meister Eckhart and the relationship between when he says what a man takes in contemplation, he must or he should pour it in love. And I was wondering, in terms of practice in Zen, of practice, let's say loving kindness practice, there is the sitting, but in other traditions there are some let's say more loving like prayers or practices that are really focusing on this second aspect of like pouring in love, and I was wondering if there was a specific practice in Zen, or if it's something that comes naturally, or
yeah. Thank you for that question. It's true, you know, as with in all things, Zen is like really simple and doesn't add a lot of different practices and things. Like we might find with Tonglen or metta meditation or something. But that doesn't mean that there's no place to express this and to put it into action. Generally, we say, you know, that's what the Sangha is. It's that our whatever we've realized as our experience of oneness, we then put that into action with our brothers and sisters in the Sangha, and in a place when we're all together in Sesshin, that's very concrete. When we're not all together in Sesshin, then that takes other forms of being together, of helping the Sangha do things, helping the teacher, whatever, participating to support financially or just in other ways. But it also then involves taking that into our daily life and then bringing that loving action into how we behave with our neighbors, our families. Bernie Blassman really formalized it into social action. And people, when he started that, people kept saying, this isn't Zen, this isn't Zen. Making brownies is not Zen. Creating jobs for the homeless is not Zen. Building apartments where they can live is not Zen. Making a daycare center for their children so they can go to work is not Zen. But it was actually the expression of the pouring out of the love that he experienced in that into daily life here and now. So yes, there is no, I mean, we sometimes do Tonglen or metta practice in Zen, but it's been kind of added on from the Tibetan and Vipassana lineages. It's not something that originates with Zen. We do have ceremonies though that, you know, and chants that we do. Although we don't do many ceremonies. The Gate of Sweet Nectar ceremony is a beautiful one for that. It's about feeding the hungry ghosts. And actually arose from one of the Buddha's disciples who had a vision of his mother who had died and was in hell, the realm of hungry ghosts. And he told the Buddha this. And so the Buddha developed this ceremony, this ritual to feed the hungry ghosts. To really put into practice our service, because that's what the Bodhisattva is about, is serving others, sharing what we have, our love and our compassion for these people who are suffering and hungry. We don't do that ceremony enough, but because we don't really do ceremonies. But maybe this summer we will again, or maybe in May when we have another present in-person retreat. But sometimes people think that because Zen isn't explicitly offering these kinds of practices, that it's not about compassion and love. But it absolutely is. There is nothing else it's about, actually.
Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe if you think about, well, okay, so why did I come here today? Why do I do this? Why do I come and sit at 8:30 in the morning, 7:30 in the morning? Why do I come to retreats? Those are all really good questions to ask that help us then to connect with, oh, okay, so my intention is this. I don't know, I can't answer for you. And I wouldn't even pretend to answer for you, but and it may change, you know, from different moment to moment, it may change. Like when I say I used to love walking in the Zendo and seeing those people sitting there, that's not the reason I came. I didn't explicitly think I'm coming to this retreat, so when I walk in the Zendo, people will be sitting there. Or when I went to live with my teacher, I didn't formally say to myself, I want to put myself in a discipline where I am always keeping focused on oneness. But in fact, that's what I wanted. I formulated it differently. I didn't want to split my life and my practice. I wanted to make it one. I didn't realize yet that it was one. I needed that discipline to help me realize that. But but it does help to question, say, okay, what am I doing? Why did I want to do this day? When I was a student myself, I didn't really think about why my teacher was setting the calendar so that we had a weekend of practice every month. We had meditation sessions almost every day, morning and night. Twice a year we had 1 week retreats. In the summer we had a month retreat. I didn't really think about why she was doing that, why she set it up that way. Now as a teacher, I think of it differently, and I know why she did that. I don't know why she still does that, but it had meaning for me. I wanted to do that. Of course, I couldn't do all of it, but I wanted to be there. I wanted to do it. But it's interesting to look and say, so why am I here? What brings me here today? Whether, like I said, whether it's one period or whether it's the whole day or... What brings me to some people on this screen did a weekend workshop, which was very intense, the Healthy Boundaries workshop. And then the next week, they did a whole week of intense sitting. And now they're sitting here today. So they must have some kind of motivation going on there. They wouldn't do that, you know. But even if you didn't do all that, you're sitting here right now. So you have some motivation. There's something there.
I won't speak much. My voice is all crooked. But it just reminds me of the question that you asked me, I don't know how many years ago now, but it was, what's the point? Exactly what you're saying. Why do you do it? I think it was the most difficult. I think koans are easier. It's the most difficult question. that I had to face, and it took me time. It took me time to find words for it. Anyway, so I just wanted to share that.
So, thank you. And now people are probably wondering. Oh, so what are those words that you found?
Probably, I don't remember, and they're different today, I'm sure.
And words will never quite capture it. They can never quite get what it is. Like I can say, I sit here and do this because of love, but that doesn't quite get it. But that's it. Debbie, yes, you had your hand up.
Just on a symbolic level, in my head, I've often compared sitting to smoking. If you only smoke a cigarette a week, it's not all that interesting. But the more you smoke, the more you like it. And the more I sit, the more I want to sit. It has its own, I suppose it's like running, although I never got into running. I hated running all the time I ran, but other physical activities, there's a positive addiction to it, I think, because it reveals itself as you go along, and it becomes, it's like reading a really good novel. What's going to be in the next chapter sort of thing, at least as far as I'm concerned. I was also very touched by what you were saying about that excitement of discovery of the practice. I felt that very much. There was nothing transcendental ever discussed in my family. My parents were straight up, but they didn't have a transcendental life. I don't think they had any transcendence at all. So when I heard about early Christians and communities of early, before the church gunked it all up, but early Christians getting together to talk about the Christ within and everything, I thought I was dead and gone to heaven. It was so exciting. It wasn't just that it was spiritual. It was exciting, like I don't know, like something that like something secular might be, like candy or something. It was very, wow, people got together in small groups to talk about Jesus. It just seemed so, and I felt that when I first started finding groups of people that sat. This is so... and put your own adjective in at the end of that sentence.
Yeah, thank you. Claudia.
Um, You know, it's just because because you just said like, oh yes, you must have a real motivation, I mean, to be here today or something. And what is really amazing is that that today began yesterday. It was something just because like yesterday night I went to a concert, and I don't know why, because I was coming today to the session day with you. I mean, yesterday was, it has already begun. And during, I don't know, I had this feeling very strong because the concert was like a mix of really beauty, but there was like some harsh events during the concert or like harsh meeting. And that was, so I was like going through like something like where like the sublime, the beauty was meeting the hard things. And I don't know why it was so much linked to today. I mean, I don't know how to explain, but it was like, it was already the sessions day yesterday night. So it was like, it was funny. I mean, it was strong. I was like, oh, and I could feel it. I could feel like I was already on with you all yesterday night. So I wanted to share that because it was strong. And you know, this morning when we all sat, always this feeling like it's always like that when I sat, it's like I don't remember the word that came, but it's something like happiness. It's always this feeling like, wow, it seems so easy and so smooth and so happy. This precise moment when you sit and you go on in the meditation. I don't know. For me, there is no other feeling when I sat. I cannot have it in my life in anywhere else. It's this pure moment when I sat. So, just to share that.
Thank you. Yeah. And that, though, that's precious to recognize that and appreciate it. And the notion of having it started yesterday, you know, like you said, and that if we really, so that's an example of, so if we have our attention on something, so that already, Claudia, you say your intention was on this day. So already you were turning your focus to the oneness, to this wholeness, this truth, whatever you want to call it. And so then already that's what it is. And the same thing applies when you get up from the screen, when you go off and do what you do, later when you sit, then tomorrow, tonight, if you keep yourself focused on that, say, this is always a retreat. That's why those Heart of Life retreats, which I promise we will do again. A whole week of, it was with the blog, but we had the schedule for the whole week, and it's really powerful, because then it's, you keep your focus, and that makes all the difference, because it is all one. It's always all one, but we're just not paying any attention to it. Claudia, yeah.
Just something more, and that was funny when you said you just said, okay, but don't forget that you're not alone, right? We are all doing that together, and that's funny because I know that, but when you remind it, it's like, yes, of course, I'm not alone. Sometimes it's kind of tough. I'm like I have all of this to do, and it's always like a relief when you say that, and it's like, oh yes, okay, thank you. No, I'm not alone. We're all together. It's always nice to hear that. I don't know why I'm forgetting that.
Yeah, we do, huh? Yeah. Okay, it's. I'm sorry if other people wanted to share. That's it for today. Thank you very much. Keep focused. Keep paying attention. And be sutras walking and sutras cooking and sutras sleeping and whatever you do. I guess, recording.